Good day, everyone, and welcome to the TFAH Outbreak Reports conference call. Today's call is being recorded. At this time, I'd like to turn the conference over to Dr. Jeff Levy. Please go ahead, sir.
Thank you very much. Good morning. I'm Jeff Levy. I'm Executive Director of the Trust for America's Health, TIFA. Thanks for joining us today for the release of a new report called Outbreaks, Protecting Americans from Infectious Diseases, which we are co-releasing with the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation. I'm pleased to be joined on the call today by Dr. Tom Inglesby, who is the CEO and director of the UPMC Center for Health Security. Tom is a leading expert on infectious disease prevention and policy, and he is also co-chair of the National Health Security Preparedness Index. I'll start off with a summary of the report and findings, and then turn it over to Tom to talk more about what the country can do to fight infectious disease threats, and then we'll open up the call to questions. The full report and state-by-state materials are available on our website, www.healthyamericans.org. We issued the outbreaks report because while the country has made huge advancements in preventing and controlling infectious diseases since the 1940s, making it possible for the majority of Americans to live much longer lives, we can't be complacent against the threat that they pose. From superbugs to salmonella to the seasonal flu, infectious diseases continue to disrupt lives and cost the country around $120 billion each year. Overall, we found that the nation's ability to prevent, control, and treat infectious diseases is hampered by outdated systems and limited resources, and the result is that it leaves Americans at an unacceptable level of unnecessary risk. We reviewed a series of 10 key indicators of infectious disease policies across the states and also reviewed the top national and global concerns. A majority of states scored a 5 or lower out of the 10 possible points. New Hampshire had the highest score, which was an 8 out of 10. Three states tied for the lowest score, 2 out of 10. These states included Georgia, Nebraska, and New Jersey. Some of our key findings include: while approximately 1 out of every 20 hospitalized patients contracts a healthcare-acquired infection during the course of their care, one-third of the states do not require healthcare facilities to report these types of healthcare-associated infections. Only one-quarter of states vaccinated at least half their population against seasonal flu. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention recommends all Americans ages 6 months and older get vaccinated. 20% of Americans get the flu each year. Only two states, Connecticut and Delaware, and Washington, D.C., meet the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services goal of vaccinating at least 90% of preschoolers 19 to 35 months old against the whooping cough. There has been a recent troubling resurgence of whooping cough in a number of states. Fewer than half of states require human papillomavirus vaccinations, education for parents about the vaccine, or funding for these vaccines. CDC and the American Academy of Pediatrics recommends the vaccination for both males and females at age 11 or 12. There have been numerous studies showing the safety of the vaccine and that vaccines do not lead to increased sexual activity among teens. HPV contributes to 20,000 new cases of cancer in women and 12,000 in men each year. One-third of states do not cover routine HIV screening under their Medicaid program. More than 1.1 million Americans are living with HIV/AIDS, but almost 1 in 5 of these individuals do not know they are infected. There are around 50,000 new infections reported each year. Just over half of public health laboratories did not test their continuity of operations plans, either through a drill or real event last year. Labs are essential for detecting, diagnosing, and controlling disease outbreaks. And two-thirds of states decreased funding for public health from fiscal year 2011-12 to fiscal year 2012-13. The report's indicators are developed in consultation with leading public health experts based on data from publicly available sources or information provided by public officials. With that, I'll turn the call over to Tom.
Thanks, Jeff. I think I'll start by just saying that there's been a widespread mistaken belief that we have in this country infectious diseases under control, and I believe that this has led to, over time, a sense of complacency and letting our guard down. And I think this report is a very welcome clarion call to refocus our efforts on infectious diseases broadly. It's important to acknowledge many of the great successes we've had in the past century, including the worldwide eradication of smallpox, the elimination of polio and rubella in the United States, And certainly the U.S. has one of the best healthcare and public health systems around the globe. I know you all are familiar with the stories you cover regarding CDC's world-leading efforts. They're disease detectives known for doing their work around the world. And in recent years, it's noteworthy to mention that American scientists are now working more closely with scientists from other countries to get a handle on new outbreaks, to get early insights, to collaborate on new diagnostics and treatments. And these efforts certainly help us to better understand diseases before they move to the U.S. and to help contain them. And so overall, we know that when public health and healthcare systems and professionals have the tools they need, they do valuable and crucial work, and they do it very well. But unfortunately, a number of issues revealed by this report show why we remain vulnerable to many infectious disease threats in this country. For example, and Jeff began to mention some of these, we have a relatively low vaccination rate in many of the in all of our age classes in this country, or lower than they should be, and lower than in other places in the world. We also have lower than we should preventive care screening rates. Our healthcare prescribers, our healthcare providers, are prescribing too many unnecessary antibiotics, and part of that is the pressure they feel from the public to do that. But this results in making medications less safe for, or less effective, rather, for all of us in the long run. And we all know, it's widely known that the pipeline for new antibiotics has dried up over the years, and we need to revitalize that pipeline and invigorate our efforts for antibiotic stewardship and proper prescribing to try and protect the antibiotics that we do have. We've seen the resurgence of a number of threats that had been virtually eradicated in the U.S. We had a spike in the number of measles cases this past year, certainly above the baseline that we'd had in years prior. We have a number of thousands of TB cases, mostly in our cities, which we need to get a better handle on. We're also facing in the global community new threats that we haven't yet had to face here, but they're appearing elsewhere in the world, and certainly there's concern that they will move here given the extent of travel in the world. We also know that there's been, with the changes in climate in our country, we will face diseases that had been virtually eradicated. For example, dengue fever, which had been eliminated in the United States, there are now increasing numbers of cases in the southern U.S. as mosquitoes return and move because of climate change. Our healthcare system and our public health system have been making strides over the years in many areas, but they still don't communicate hand in glove in the way that we would really like them to in preventing and responding to outbreaks. For example, we've really made big moves in the last few years in terms of moving towards electronic health records in our hospitals and in our clinics, and that over the long run should improve care and improve information flow in the clinical system. But the public health system has been largely left out of that movement towards electronic health records. So they are going to have difficulty benefiting from what we learn and the efficiencies and the new information that we can get out of that electronic health record unless we start making a better effort to include public health in that process. We also have just-in-time systems in our hospitals. So our hospitals don't have a lot of flexibility for surges in disasters. In some places, that's going to be more pronounced than others. And in terms of the foodborne outbreak threats that we face, there's been major legislation that's passed regarding improving food safety, but those changes outlined in the law have not yet been implemented. We have also lost a serious number of scientists and public health professionals in recent years due to budget cuts, the number that that is most shocking, perhaps, is the loss of 40,000 public health jobs in the last 5 years. And finally, some of the threats that we've been hearing about in the last year, which remain important and not yet fully understood, are the Middle East Respiratory Syndrome virus, which has been predominantly in the Middle East and has caused about 165 cases of illness and with a case fatality rate of about 43%. We still don't fully understand that virus and how it's spreading. And we don't have tools yet in place to treat it or prevent it with vaccine. So there's going to be this is illustrative of the kinds of new outbreaks that we should expect to face in the years ahead, and the importance of remaining vigilant in the fight against infectious diseases, and in the research base and in the talent pool, the doctors, the nurses, the public health professionals that we'll need in the years ahead for these problems. So I want to just come back to the outbreaks report that Jeff and his group have released today. I think it's a very important report. I think it also is in keeping with the recent National Health Security Preparedness Index, which was released a few weeks ago by 27 partner organizations, including including my own Antifa. And these reports, I think, will help highlight ways that we can continue to improve the quality and investment in our systems to prevent and respond to infectious diseases. And I'll leave that there and turn it back to Jeff.
Thanks so much, Tom. I'll conclude by going over some of our major recommendations in the outbreaks report. We have many more broken down by issue within the report as well. To improve the prevention, control, and treatment of infectious diseases, we must focus on a number of things. First and probably foremost, strengthening the fundamental capabilities, maintaining an expert workforce, and giving them the state-of-the-art tools required to conduct investigations to quickly detect, control, and treat disease outbreaks. We need to be countering antibiotic resistance and prioritizing research and development of medical countermeasures. They should be top health and national security priorities. We're pleased that the FDA this week finalized new guidance regarding overuse of antibiotics in animals and are taking steps to require more veterinary oversight of their use. We hope recently passed legislation will spur new antibiotic development and that the FDA will receive additional regulatory authority to approve antimicrobials for limited populations, filling an unmet medical need and delaying drug resistance. We need to be increasing the number of Americans receiving recommended vaccinations and routine screenings for particular diseases, since these are the safest and most effective ways to reduce infectious diseases in the United States. We need to modernize disease surveillance and ensure public health laboratories have the equipment and capacity to not only test for routine problems like foodborne illness, but also to find new and large-scale threats like bioterrorism or a pandemic. We need to be supporting policies and incentives to reduce the number of healthcare-associated infections, ensuring Americans can receive safe care. We need to be improving global coordination to prevent and contain emerging new disease illnesses like MERS, while maintaining defenses against old-school threats like malaria and tuberculosis. Shoring up the nation's public health preparedness capabilities is also important so we can respond to major disease outbreaks or acts of bioterrorism to ensure new threats can be rapidly identified and contained. And we need to be countering complacency around HIV/AIDS, hepatitis B and C, and tuberculosis, including countering an alarming rise in new HIV infections among young gay men and screening millions of baby boomers who may be infected with hepatitis C and do not know they are at risk for developing serious liver disease as they age, and particularly at a time when more successful and easier treatments are available. We must remain vigilant. We can do so by ensuring we have the policies and resources in place to allow scientists and public health and medical experts to have the tools they need to control ongoing outbreaks, to detect new or re-emerging outbreaks, and to monitor for potential bioterrorist threats. With that, let's go ahead and open up the call for any questions, and just a reminder that the report and state-by-state materials are available on TIFA's website at www.healthyamericans.org. Operator?
Thank you, sir. If you'd like to ask a question, please signal by pressing star 1 on your telephone keypad. If you're using a speakerphone, please make sure your mute function is turned off to allow your signal to reach our equipment. Again, please press star 1 to ask a question, and we'll pause for a moment to allow everyone an opportunity to signal. And we'll take our first question from Robert Lowe's with Medscape Medical News.
Hi, Cole. How do you expect to achieve the goals that you've set out when the United States is in a, and the United States Congress is in an era of, I would say, fiscal austerity and deficit reduction? Is it realistic to expect that you can find the funding for the reasonable goals that you set out?
I think the answer to that is yes and no. Yes, in the sense that one of the reasons we're putting out this report is to shine a light on the vulnerabilities we have. And if you look into the report, you can see program by program by program at the CDC in particular, but also at the NIH as well, cuts in everything you would be concerned about, research at the National Institute for Allergy and Infectious Diseases, the Public Health Emergency Preparedness funding, the immunization funding. I mean, you just go through every program at the CDC and you will see these cuts, some of which are a result of multiple years of budget cuts and austerity, some of them resulting from the sequester. Mm-hmm. So I think we're hoping for two outcomes here. One is that with this budget agreement and the possibility to avoid bigger cuts and perhaps restore some funding to health programs, that this will be one of the priority areas. Mm-hmm. But I also think it is also necessary to look at the base and make sure that we are prioritizing the right activities so that we don't fall further and further behind.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And we'll go next to Chris Kardish with Governing Magazine.
I mean, you just talked about the federal level. You know, state budgets are just sort of beginning to recover, and revenue is still basically flat. I mean, you know, how would you press a state level leader to put more funding into this when they've got so many competing demands, be them higher education or various other areas?
Well, I think you're making a really good point, and when you look at in detail the budget numbers, not only do we have a number of states that have cut their budget in the last year, most states have cut their budget in the last year. For some, this is a multi-year, for about a third of the states, this is a multi-year experience, and that's getting at the core. And one of the reasons we talk in this report about assuring foundational capabilities for public health agencies, including surveillance and response to infectious diseases, that is a core mission for state health departments and a core responsibility for the states. So as budgets begin to the budget situation begins to improve, we're hoping that, again, that this will be a priority at the state and local level. But I also think that even within health budgets, we need to make sure that we're doing some of these preventive measures so that, you know, when there is an outbreak of whooping cough or there's an outbreak of measles, no one questions the costs that are going to be associated with responding. We have to respond. It can be far more cost-effective and certainly more efficient to do the prevention. And, you know, we highlight a lot of issues around vaccines. And, you know, in the past, that has often been a cost borne by health departments. With the Affordable Care Act, this is now a shared responsibility. These are required to be reimbursed by health plans in the private sector and those, including those sold on the exchange. So as more people gain insurance, as people gain insurance under the Medicaid expansion, these vaccines, for example, will be covered first dollar coverage. And so some of the delivery dollars that have been spent in the past can be reoriented toward educating the public so they have a better understanding and are more willing to take advantage of these services. So I think there are opportunities here to be more creative in using existing dollars to increase access to some of these preventive services.
Thanks.
And we'll take our next question from Lisa Schnurring with SIDRAP News.
Hi. Thanks so much for offering this today and the amazing array of information. I just wanted to ask, do you see any changes from last year? I know that sometimes it's hard because you tweak the indicators that you look at to find the best ones, but was there anything either on the positive side or the negative side where you saw some changes that really jumped out at you? Thanks so much.
Sure. So this is a different report. In the past, we issued a report called Ready or Not that really focused on preparedness. And because of the work that Dr. Inglesby has done with the National Health Security Preparedness Index, we have, in a sense, retired at least that part of the report and are focusing more broadly on infectious diseases. So this, there isn't entirely a year-to-year comparison, except, you know, a few of the indicators are common, and, you know, the one that we've just been talking about, which is state budgeting, that's the one where we have not seen improvement. It's our hope, as we saw with the Ready or Not report, and as I think Dr. Inglesby would attest, we're hoping to see with the Preparedness Index, that as scores are public, as people understand where some of the gaps are, we will see from year to year some improvements.
Thank you.
And we'll take our next question from Kathleen O'Brien with the Star Ledger.
Hi, I was wondering if you could give us more examples of the impact that climate change might have on public health beyond the dengue fever one.
Sure. So I think there are multiple elements. I mean, some of them are related to sort of the northward progression of some infectious diseases. And then there are other elements that have also tremendous public health implications. So more heat waves, more disruptive weather, more floods, heavier rains, those sorts of things. But, you know, as we've seen each summer when there are some serious heat waves, particularly in cities that have not experienced a lot of heat in the past, there tend to be deaths, particularly among the elderly and those living in housing that does not have air conditioning. And some of the severe weather events like Hurricane Sandy can also, you know, if we, you know, as is at least predicted, if we're going to see more and more events like that, those have tremendous ramifications. Tom, I don't know whether there's anything you would want to add sort of on the infectious disease front.
No, I think the dengue is the most obvious example of, you know, it's kind of a clear pattern, but there are other viruses like, for example, viruses that we don't have in this hemisphere that, like chikungunya virus, for example, was just announced this week that they have found chikungunya in the on the island of St. Martin in the Caribbean, and it probably would be a matter of time before that is found in a southern state. And the more that we have mosquitoes that can carry these viruses in our states, the more that we have them moving up to the north, the higher the chance that we'll have these viruses. But I think dengue is probably the most obvious example for now.
Thank you.
And we'll go next to Kim Mulford with the Courier Post.
I'm just interested in hearing some immediate budget-friendly things that can be done to improve a state's showing in your report. I'm in New Jersey where we have 2 out of a possible 10 points. Can you talk a little bit about that, please?
So from a budget-friendly standpoint, you know, not everything can be done on the cheap, but certainly even within existing resources, you know, getting vaccination rates up through some public education certainly would be one way of achieving that. There, you know, it is at no cost for example, to have a complete climate adaptation plan that would include a focus on the impact of human health. There would be no cost to increasing awareness and potentially even requiring, as we recommend, HPV vaccination to, again, spare both ultimately young men and young women from thousands of cancers. Making progress, even keeping a flat budget would actually get them a better indicator in that regard. Some things can't be done on the cheap. You cannot increase your lab capacity to be able to handle a surge without expending the resources to do it. That's the reality.
Thank you.
And we'll take our next question from Michael Smith with MedPage Today.
I have two quick ones. One is purely technical. The indicator for HPV seems to me to be a three-parter. You can require vaccines,
right.
You can require education, and I think there's a third part, but it's an or. And I'm wondering how many states actually require the HPV vaccine specifically, as opposed to requiring education for parents or guardians or the third part, whatever it was. That's the first question.
Yeah, and I am going to have to get back to you on the specifics about how many required. I'm not sure that any do yet, and that's one of the reasons why we made it a broader recommendation. We support making it a requirement, but that's just not the case yet. And so just getting the word out and countering some of the misinformation about the HPV vaccine, as we saw recently with the Katie Kirk show, is one of the reasons that we highlighted this.
Okay, so it's possible, in fact, that all of the states who got a point for that actually are doing so because they're putting out some information rather than
correct.
Actually.
That's correct. Absolutely. Yes, yes.
Okay. The other question is, you alluded to the ACA and its possible effects. Do you expect that one of the functions of the ACA over the next year or so will be to improve some of these indicators? Are you expecting to see them go up because of that change? And I guess another way of putting that is this maybe a year or so premature because the picture is changing?
Well, so the ACA, I hope that the numbers will be better a year from now. I think what the ACA does is it removes the financial roadblock in those, and it's particularly valuable in those states that are doing a Medicaid expansion because it will be required to be covered there. Many of these services will be required to be covered there. But I think, this could be also perceived as a baseline. But people will not take advantage of these preventive services unless there is encouragement and awareness. So just having a benefit, Dr. Inglesby practices medicine on a daily basis. And I think he could speak to the fact that it takes provider initiative and patient awareness to even take advantage of your benefits.
Thank you.
And we'll take our next question from Claire Hughes with the Albany Times Union.
Hello, thank you. I have two questions. One is just a practical one. I wanted to sort of look underneath some of this data for New York State, just on a couple of the indicators. And, is it possible, where is this coming from, CDC site? For instance, that let's look at one of the things I'm interested in is in the seasonal flu.
Right.
Where can I find where you're getting
those? Those are CDC data, and if you go to the indicator in the report, you will see a link to where we got the data.
Oh, okay, thank you. And then the other question has to do with that. I wondered if someone could comment for me. When I look at New York's ranking, and the state did really well among these indicators, but it kind of looks like we're better prepared for some emerging disaster than we are for, say, combating seasonal flu. And I wonder if somebody has any comment on that.
So I can, I'd ask Tom to join me in terms of the, some of the preparedness response. Clearly, you know, there's a budget challenge for New York. That was one of the indicators New York did not get. You know, most states did not reach the seasonal flu threshold that we set here. So I think New York has a lot in common with the rest of the country. And so, you know, that there are always those kinds of gaps. But certainly New York has been through trial by fire and a lot of preparedness issues. And so with that experience, has certainly built up its preparedness capacity.
Okay, so but looking at the issue of something like seasonal flu, half of the population doesn't just intuitively strike me as a very high benchmark. You said it, you know, that there were the reason that you said it, and is there, I don't know. I'm just wondering if there are lessons from states that are vaccinating more than half or something along those lines that I might look at.
Well, I think some of it has to do with the education campaigns that are undertaken. I think some of it has to do with the aggressiveness with which there is comparison. There are pharmacies and other efforts made to make the vaccine as accessible as possible. But, you know, clearly when only 12 states have reached that 50% threshold, we still have a lot more work to do in this area.
And the only thing that I would add to what Jeff said is the observation that many times these kinds of reports like outbreaks or the report National Health Security Preparedness Index that came out a few weeks ago are just the beginning of the examination of the differences. So it may be the case that many states aren't even really aware of the differences between what they're doing and other states, but these kinds of reports, we don't always know when these reports are published. We see the difference in the data, and we're hopeful when we publish these reports that it initiates a process of review of certain practices, comparison of best practices or leading practices across the country, and that it's a tool for helping prompt conversation and review of quality and of strategies around these things. So we may not know exactly what's behind a particular number. We can have an intuition about it, but I think it's going to be, this is hopefully the beginning of a process both for both of these reports where states can examine things that they find appealing in other places of the country. They can be excited about the work that they're doing if they've come up with a leading indicator. And it's the beginning of a process of examination.
And we'll take our next question from Marnie Jameson with Orlando Sentinel.
Good morning. Thank you. I have two questions also. One is sort of a clarification regarding the Middle East respiratory syndrome. Did you say that we've had 165 cases here in the United States? And how is it that we can sort of practice some surveillance so that doesn't become a greater problem here now that we have some awareness of that it is here and you all have some kind of an ability to hopefully stop that in its tracks? And the second question is regarding the foodborne outbreaks and the major legislation you said that had been put in place, but the changes in law had not been implemented yet. I wondered if you could be a little bit more specific about what those laws are beyond the FDA's cracking down on antibiotics in animals, and also how that might pertain to the Cyclospora outbreak that we encountered this year. Florida was one of the few dozen states or so that had some of that. So anyway, I know that's kind of wide-ranging question, but those are my questions at the moment. Thanks.
Well, Jeff, maybe I'll take the first one since I clarify. Actually, I've got to clarify what I said, and then you could take the second.
Yeah.
So I'm sorry if I wasn't clear when I spoke earlier. We've had zero cases of MERS in this country,
okay.
But are on the lookout for it. There have been 165 cases in the world. Most of those cases have been in the Middle East, and some of them have been travelers returning to their home countries or visiting countries in Europe. And because of the frequency of travel between the Middle East and the United States, it would not be surprising if in the year ahead we had a case of MERS. And I think to your point about how can we do more surveillance, I think there is some awareness in emergency rooms and clinics about the Middle Eastern Respiratory Syndrome virus. State laboratories do have a test for it. So if the state health laboratory is contacted quickly when people suspect a case, then I think we certainly have the capacity to diagnose it in this country. And it's basically a matter of continuing vigilance in the healthcare community so that they would have the proper suspicion of seeing someone who they believe might have that disease and getting the right lab test.
And did you say there were 40 or so deaths as a result from these 165? So is it a fairly
big? It is. It's got a very high case fatality rate. There have been about 70 fatalities out of the 165 cases, so it's got about a 40% case fatality rate. There probably are many other cases that we don't know about, so maybe that case fatality rate is going to come down as we learn more about people who got mild illness and haven't been counted yet. But at least for the numbers of people that have confirmed diagnosis, there is a very high case fatality rate, which makes it a very important virus in the world.
Thank you.
And then with regard to your other two questions about regulations, the Food Safety Modernization Act really was an effort on the part of the Congress and the President to articulate a preventive standard. So much of around food safety, so much of what we do is reactive when outbreaks occur. And this is really designed to instill in our food production system more of a preventive standard. We know what can prevent some of these outbreaks, and so why don't we start there? But to implement that law requires the issuance of regulations, and those regulations have been stalled for a number of years now, and we are just hoping that we will begin to see some of those move out of the agency and out of the Office of Management and Budget. One area where we did see progress last week was around use of antibiotics in animals, where that is now going to be more severely restricted because that is one of the bases for the development of antibiotic resistance. But again, those regulations took years to see the light, to be finalized. And with these kinds of public health threats, we really need to see a little bit more urgency, a lot more urgency, in fact, in the movement of regulations through the system.
And as a reminder, if you'd like to signal to ask a question, please press star 1. We'll go next to Shemaine Mills with Wisconsin Public Radio.
Hi, thanks for taking the call. My question is about whooping cough. In 2012, Wisconsin was one of the states that had a high number of cases of pertussis. We have a policy that exempts those with personal convictions or religious reasons. Do you think this plays a role in the whooping cough outbreak?
I think it does. I think we've become a little bit lax in probably granting these exemptions. I think whooping cough may be one of those areas where because we did such a good job, people's fear and people's concerns are diminished. Infectious diseases is a perfect example where you can never become lax. You know, we saw that in the 1980s with the resurgence of tuberculosis, and so then we had to re-gear up and respond to that. We shouldn't always be playing a game of catch-up. We need to make sure that the American people understand the ongoing threat and that we keep the systems in place, whether it's, you know, relatively tough vaccination requirements or whether it's really strong surveillance systems so we can identify outbreaks quickly and respond well. All those pieces need to be in place on a constant basis. We can't always be playing catch-up. That's how you lose lives and how diseases get out of control.
The only thing that I would add to that is that in the case of whooping cough, I think there's also a misunderstanding in the public generally, or at least in some cases, that this is a disease which you get vaccinated for as a kid and you're protected for a lifetime, and the adult, you know, people don't have the instinct that they need to get properly vaccinated as an adult. And so that can, both childhood vaccination rates and adult vaccination rates are really important for whooping cough. And there's one additional factor which we're learning more about, but it may be the case also that the vaccine that we're using now isn't as effective against whooping cough. As it's a very good vaccine, and we should continue to use it, but it maybe we need an even stronger vaccine to get even higher immunization rates.
And that's why, you know, we have recommendations around increased investment in research and development, whether it's developing more effective vaccines, as in the case of whooping cough, or perhaps even developing a universal vaccine for the flu, so we don't need to use a different vaccine each year, as well as dealing with the the resistance that may develop to antibiotics, or in the case of things like tuberculosis, where resistance is developing to the standard treatments. That's the reason for needing a consistent and perhaps growing research and development budget as well.
Thank you.
We'll go next to James Dawson with Delaware Public Media.
Hi, thank you. So when I was looking over this, Delaware seems to rank among the leaders nationwide, but what really needs more to be done, in your opinion, to better position ourselves for the future, especially when our latest revenue forecast that just came out yesterday isn't so rosy?
Well, you know, it's always a matter of priorities, and even in limited times, in fact, it's particularly in limited times that I think we need to look at our core values and determine what we're going to invest in. And I think the American people, certainly when they're surveyed, look to the government to protect them and to put policies and systems in place to protect them from things over which they have no control. And infectious diseases couldn't be a better example of that. But there's also a federal responsibility. It's not just a state responsibility. Infectious diseases don't honor state borders by any stretch of the imagination. And there is a federal responsibility as well to assure a baseline of protection, whether it's against infectious diseases or it's around preparedness, so that where you live does not determine whether you are going to be protected, and so that we can be sure that those threats that are of a contagious nature do not cross state lines. So, you know, some of this is around priorities, and some of it is also around reexamining how we are using existing resources. So the example I gave earlier around immunizations, with more insurance coverage, perhaps some of the immunization dollars could be retargeted to getting people, you know, educating people about the value of doing so. Some of these are policy changes. The HPV vaccine is going to be covered by insurance companies, but if school systems don't require that kids have it, they're less likely to. That's a policy change. It doesn't really cost any money. So there are things in this, recommendations in this report, don't need to cost money, that could make a difference in terms of health outcomes.
Mm-hmm. As far as Delaware specifically, anything else aside from maybe HPV education?
Well, you know, I would be careful not to consider these indicators. So the other indicator that Delaware did not achieve besides the budget one was also around climate change adaptation plans. So, you know, this is, you know, incredibly important, especially for states that have a water border, to incorporate. And that, again, is with at minimal cost to the state. You know, these are 10 indicators. These are not suggesting that, you know, there are no challenges that states, you know, with high scores face. So, you know, there are things in here, you know, hepatitis C would be a perfect example, where there are new treatments, and so doing more to make sure that particularly boomers who might be infected with hepatitis C and not know it, learn their status to see if they can take advantage of these new treatments that represent a cure, would certainly be one example. The increased rates of HIV in all jurisdictions, regardless of policy around HIV screening in Medicaid, really requires a close look at the dollars that are being spent and whether they are being targeted based on who is at risk, both on the prevention side and on the care side, and making sure that the quality of care people are getting assures that people with HIV are virally suppressed, so therefore they're less likely to transmit the virus. So there are policy things, there are systems things, and then there obviously are elements that they can undertake that may cost money. So not everything has to cost money. It can be making sure we are doing a better job with the existing resources as well.
Thank you.
We'll take our next question from Patrick O'Connor with AAP News.
Hi, thank you. I was wondering if you could identify some common threads among the states that do well and among those that do not as well, whether it's policy-wise, funding-wise, or other factors. Thanks.
I wish it were that simple, but unfortunately, I think what we found is that different states with low scores have, obviously you have a very low score, there's going to be some commonality that there's a broad range of things to undertake, but I don't know that there's a pattern that we could discern among the high-scoring states versus the low-scoring states, but what I think you can find in looking at these are some general weaknesses, because when you have only a dozen states meeting the flu vaccination threshold, when you only have two states meeting the whooping cough vaccination threshold, and only 17 states maintaining their budget, I think those are certainly core to every state. You know, those are certainly very common in terms of the weaknesses that are out there.
We'll take our next question from John Smith with WAER, Syracuse University.
I was just wondering, you're mentioning climate, control or disease associated with weather events, and because Hurricane or Superstorm Sandy was such a big event here in New York, just wondering if you noticed anything in looking at the data after and in the aftermath?
So I don't know, and I'd turn to Tom to see if he does. I don't know of any specific infectious diseases outbreaks that were associated with Sandy. There were certainly the risk, and I think a great concern about that. And I think that's one of the reasons why we included climate change adaptation as part of an infectious diseases report.
Okay. Thank you.
I would just say that there were, I think there are a number of studies underway to try and better get a handle on the health effects, what happened during Superstorm Sandy. There were entire hospitals that had to be abandoned in the middle of the night with critical care patients being moved in the middle of the night, their dialysis centers that were disrupted, methadone clinics that were taken offline. So there are lots of kind of primary hospital-based implications of Sandy, and then a lot of things that were happening in the kinds of clinics or specialty centers that sometimes aren't on the radar screen. I don't know that they've been summed up in one place, but I know there's work going on along those lines.
Thank you.
We'll go next to Tom Corwin with Augusta Chronicle.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. As we're in Georgia and we're among the lowest-ranked states, how should people interpret this? How should people interpret this ranking if they're just reading about this? Are they at greater risk in your mind?
I think in principle, yes, they are at greater risk, certainly for those conditions and the ability to respond that we look at. There may be other areas of strength for which there may not have been state-by-state data that are comparable. But yes, if I lived in a jurisdiction where we have lower vaccination rates than we should, where we aren't planning for things like climate change, I would be worried. And I think that's the goal of this report, is to get people to pay, both policymakers and the public, to pay closer attention to the capacity of the government to protect us. We're talking here about things over which we have very little personal control. And so that's where we do need a strong government effort.
Thank you.
We'll go next to Prue Zalaski with the Daily Press.
Hi, thanks. I came a little late to the discussion, and I'm interested in what you said about dengue fever as being the most obvious example of climate-related disease change. Could you either repeat what you said that I missed or tell me why it's so obvious?
Tom?
Sure. I think it's, I mean, it's obvious in the sense that it's the most serious disease that has been eliminated from this country in principle in the past and is now beginning to reoccur with greater frequency in southern states. We believe because of changes in climate, which now allow mosquitoes that had been that had not been present to be present in our southern climate, but also because we have, I mean, there have been cuts to the mosquito-related diseases programs at the federal level, and there has been some loss of the kinds of local public knowledge about mosquito control that used to be so important, but began to fade a little bit in practice because we didn't have those kinds of mosquito-borne threats. We're going to need to kind of get back into the practice of eliminating standing water in southern states to make sure mosquitoes don't have a home. And in addition to, you know, the larger scale mosquito eradication efforts, those are going to be really important for people to be vigilant about mosquitoes and what, you know, what makes it easy for mosquitoes to live in a community. But that's what I meant by saying it was the most obvious. It's the most serious disease that really has changed in pattern because of climate change in the U.S.
So can you tell me, I mean, is that over a decade, over 2 decades? Is it in?
I think it's in the last few years. In the last few years, we've started seeing increasing numbers of cases in southern, in mostly in Florida, Texas, and Hawaii. So it's not a widely prevalent across the country, but we should expect, we should do what we can to try and make sure that doesn't appear in other places. But the mosquitoes that carry dengue travel up much further north than those states where we have found dengue.
Okay. And is there a treatment for it?
No, there's not a treatment for dengue. It's just hospital care, you know, good hospital care, and most people survive dengue, although it occasionally is a lethal disease. It's quite a painful and serious disease, but with American medical care, it has a very high survival rate.
Okay. Thank you.
Sure.
We'll go next to Virginia Gordon with Michigan Radio NPR.
Thank you very much. You touched on this question before, but I just want to get up to the macro level for a second. I'm from one of the states that scored 5, and I'm just wondering if you could summarize what you think is a takeaway for the public in hearing that its state scored 5. What is the level of concern? What is the conclusion you would draw?
I think the general conclusion I would draw is that fighting these diseases requires constant vigilance. There are gaps in almost every state's ability to respond. Sometimes it's in vaccination rates, sometimes it's in laboratory capacity, sometimes it's in policies or investment of resources in creating the defenses that are needed. But across the board, we are not being, and this is not news, in the sense that, you know, this has been a constant struggle for decades now of maintaining a constant vigilance around infectious diseases. You know, I mentioned earlier we saw that with tuberculosis of stopping and starting and stopping and starting and always paying a price for the stopping part. I would argue that, you know, one of the reasons we're seeing this resurgence in new HIV infections among young gay men is becoming a little bit complacent about having new treatments and assuming that people always have the message. with each year, we have another generation, another cohort of young people and adults who need to get the prevention message, whether it's about getting vaccinations or whether it's around behavior change that will prevent transmission of a disease. And we haven't been keeping up. And so I think the bottom line here is that wherever you live, whether your score is good or is bad, it requires the investment and constant vigilance to protect us.
Thank you.
We'll go next to Tegan Hanlon with Anchorage Daily News. Please go ahead. Your line is open.
Oops, sorry, I was muted for a second. Thanks for taking my call. I had a question about the funding levels. I was reading in the report that it seems like Alaska receives the highest level of federal funding per person at $53.07, which seems pretty significant compared to Indiana's funding levels at $13.72. So I was just wondering if you could speak to this variance a little bit, and also further going into the indicator, is that increased or maintained level of funding, is that across the board for federal, local, and state, or all of them combined, or how does that indicator work?
Okay. So the indicator is strictly about state funding for public health. So it does not incorporate federal funding. So those are two separate issues. And so what you're seeing there is whether a state maintained or increased funding at the state level. So what did the state legislature do in their appropriations process? What the report also does is outline what's happened to a number of federal programs, most of them at CDC, but one of them also at NIH, and also the Hospital Preparedness Program that is run out of the Assistant Secretary for Preparedness and Response. And what you will see is a downward trajectory over the last 4 or 5 years. That is quite significant. So the differential on a state, on a per capita basis, has many explanations, and so there isn't going to be a simple answer to that. In some cases, it has to do with states being just more successful in competing for some of this money, because some of these grant programs are awarded on a competitive basis. Some of it also may be population-related, that every state gets a minimum amount regardless in some of these grants, regardless of their size, and so smaller states then obviously on a per capita basis may be getting more money. So I think there are a variety of explanations there. But it obviously does relate, when you see that kind of differential, it does then relate back then to differences in capacity in some of those communities.
And it appears there are no further questions at this time. Dr. Levy, I'll turn the call back over to you for any additional or closing remarks.
Thank you very much. Thank you all for being on this call, and particularly thank you to Tom Inglesby for joining me on this call. And, again, we will be available for any follow-up questions, and all the materials are available on our website, www.healthyamericans.org. Thank you, and have a good day.
Thank you, and that does conclude today's conference call. Thank you for your participation.